On this episode of Selling Isn't Everything, you're going to get to hear from sales leader and CRO of Deputy, Jamie Buss. Now, this isn't an ordinary sales leader. Sure, she leads huge global teams and is a badass. But what you're going to hear is a human being who really sees people. You're going to hear from a mother, a parent, and a leader. You're going to learn about how to find out what really motivates people, not the what, but the why. So join me and the amazing Jamie Buss on this episode of Selling Isn't Everything. Let's dig in. What I'm thinking is that when I'm in California, I don't have my husband there all the time when we're at our California place. And like, I need a rent a CIO.
Yeah, well, I definitely need it because I wouldn't have been able to set this all up myself. So yeah.
Jamie, aren't you a trained engineer at one of the like best engineering universities in the entire world?
You know, I didn't realize it was a good engineering school when I applied. What's the irony? I just thought I wanted an environmental engineering degree and Cal Poly happened to have it. And so I just naively applied to there and I think Humboldt and Syracuse. Very interesting group of schools. And yeah, I got in and I didn't realize it was hard to get in when I applied. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to apply.
Well, so, wait a minute. You hadn't seen Young Sheldon yet? You didn't know that Young Sheldon ends up going to Cal Poly and like, because he's such a brainiac, like you had no idea?
I had no idea. No, I didn't. My parents, I'm Gen X. My parents are like, go figure out college. And I'm like, well, I really want to understand how the environment works. And there weren't many places you could study environmental engineering. Cal Poly had me one of them. I applied to all these schools, never having visited a school. My parents are like, we're not visiting schools. So you can look at the flyer and decide where you want to apply. And thank goodness I got in. I loved it. It was amazing career in education. Or that law helped launch my career, but I kind of accidentally fell into it.
But back up a minute. Like, you know, what happened that made you want to study environmental engineering?
My mom actually questioned that too, because I was actually a very strong English student. I loved writing. Mm-hmm. I loved interpreting fiction. And I was the highest achiever in grades in AP English in high school. And she's like, you're only a B student in math. Why are you applying to engineering? By the way, the head of the math department in my high school told me, I don't know why you're trying so hard in office hours. I don't know why you're trying so hard. You'll never be better than a B student, which I don't recommend anybody say to anyone, especially not a student. But I thought that was like, huh, I wonder if that's true. But my mom always said, you're smart enough to do anything you want. And so I think that belief overrode this curmudgeon who told me I didn't understand why I was trying so hard. I am a first child and I do have a lot of grit and I don't give up easily. And I wanted to go to college and I wanted to do something hard. I wanted to go and do something that I knew I'd be able to cash into some kind of career at some point. And I knew if I got some kind of technical degree, that would set me up better than if I'd gone down the arts track. And I really wanted to learn about, you know, that was way back in the day. This is late 90s, but I was really curious. Like things like acid rain were being talked about. And I lived in SoCal, so the inversion layer with smog. And I wanted to understand how that worked and how it could be impacted. And that's what drew me to the environmental and engineering path, was kind of my drive to do something difficult combined with my desire to learn more about the environment. And by the way, I have to say, never got a lower grade than an A in any math course in college. Thank you very much.
Why am I not surprised?
Well, let me ask you, because it's an interesting story of motivation and sort of where do you land on intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation? So the extrinsic would be, you know, this math teacher told me that I can't get A, so I'm going to put a chip on my shoulder and prove him or her wrong, versus, no, this is just for me and what I want to do, irrespective of what the world expects of me. This is just what's going to make me either happiest or most successful or most fulfilled. Are both those things in operation at the same time for you, Jamie, or is one stronger than the other, do you think?
I think that it's much more intrinsic than it is what anyone has said to me. I have a philosophy that if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it the best I can do. I'm going to leave it all on the floor. I'm very competitive, but I'm also a love to win type of competitive. And I just really expect that if I put effort into something, then the right outcome will happen. And so while I remember the feeling of that comment, it kind of hit home. I could feel it in the body. It wasn't a good feeling. It's like when I was in track. I was a volleyball player. I was decent. And I did track for off season. And the coach pulled me aside and said, you know, you really have no talent, but you have a really good attitude. And that's why I'm keeping you on the team.
You were just surrounded by really helpful people, weren't you?
I was kind of shocking, but you can tell this was so many years ago. And they still were very formative for me because I still remember those conversations very distinctly.
It was juxtaposed with your mother telling you you can do or be anything, which is interesting.
Right. And I have a very close relationship with my mother. And I trusted her more than I trusted these men who were telling me that I couldn't be good enough throughout my career. I just believed, no, why can't I do this? It takes effort. I have grit. I have resilience. I'm brave. I'll tell you, when I was graduating college, I really wanted to retrain myself because I had done an internship for environmental engineering and it was like watching paint dry. And I realized this was not going to be the career for me. And I had to retrain myself. And I really wanted to go work for one of the big systems integrators because I knew that they had a really great training program and I could learn how to be more of a technologist. And I applied to get an interview with Deloitte Consulting and all they'd seen is my resume. And I didn't get an interview. And I was shocked because I had 3.5 GPA, which I'd worked exceedingly hard for. I'm mildly dyslexic. Let me tell you, that is not easy to pull off. I had to go to every office hour and play the ref in every instance I could in order to keep that 3.5. I worked very hard. And I was an officer in the sorority. I had the Honor Keys Society. I mean, I had like all the check boxes. And I thought, how can you say no just based on paper? And I didn't think that was acceptable. So the night before the day of the interview, I took out my, in retrospect, fairly ugly Ann Taylor suit. And I laid it out on the closet so it could straighten out because I didn't have an iron. I was in college. So I lay it out and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to show up tomorrow in my suit. And if someone knows shows, if they have an opening, I'm just going to say, hey, listen, I realize you guys, you know, hadn't accepted my application, but I'd love the opportunity to sit down with you if an opportunity arises. Turns out that night before I get a call, and it's Deloitte. And they say, hey, Jamie, we had an opening opened up for tomorrow. Would you be interested to come in an interview? And I said, funny you should mention that. I was planning to come in anyway. My suit is hanging there in the closet and I will be there. What time do you need me there? And I got the opportunity. I'm very good at like on my feet, answering questions like that. I'm usually fairly good at that. And I was able to get the job. But I was just like, no, you can't say no to me based on paper. You know how hard I worked on that piece of paper? I spent 5 years getting all those things on that piece of paper.
You know, it's interesting though, Jimmy, because as a leader now, I would imagine to some degree, the shoe's on the other foot or not. I mean, you've got to make relatively rapid decisions across both personnel and strategy based on limited inputs, just like Deloitte had to in that hiring process. And now I would imagine, probably not explicitly or consciously, but you probably in some way connect back to that experience and you probably go through these. Sometimes I would imagine, if not snap, just very rapid decisions, very complex decisions in time-constrained environments that you have to make. Has that experience affected that? Do you force yourself to slow down? Do you look for more inputs based on, hey, I don't want to happen to this decision, what happened to me personally at Deloitte, or not? Or has it had no sort of impact on how you think about making decisions yourself?
I feel that over time, I have built up enough. I have good pattern recognition and I'm fairly intuitive. And I kind of combine those two things to listen to my intuition. Do I have enough data to make this decision? Or is this one that I'm going to have to make without having the data at hand? This could be figuring out an approach of how we're going to sell in one market versus another. I'm going to want some data on that. But maybe we're looking to make a hire. And, you know, in there, I'm going to probably follow my intuition because if there's anything I've learned when it comes to hiring, this is especially when I've talked with someone, I'm not doing a ton of resume. I usually will, at this point, you know, I'm giving folks kind of direction on what I'm looking for. And then I'll kind of do one of the first screens for one of the leaders. But on paper, I want enough scale, but it's when I'm meeting them that when I fail to listen to my intuition is when I regret not listening to that. And then in retrospect, it's what did I miss? It's like, oh, you know what? I knew it. They didn't actually bring enough examples with data to anything. They didn't give me enough detailed answers. Or it was clear that this wasn't a habit for them because they weren't able to provide X, Y, or Z. So this trait is not a habit. They were just trying to answer my question. And usually I know that those things are happening, but if I ignore it, I usually regret it later.
So, you know, what's interesting, I'm hearing you talk about your, and I know you are very, very data driven. And Jamie and I are on a board together. We're on the Grow AI board. And so I've gotten a chance to get to know you professionally too, which has been lovely. And you're definitely data driven. I love what you said about pattern recognition, because I think successful people do have this pattern recognition. But then you also talked about intuition. And I'm curious, when you're talking about intuition, and earlier you said, I could feel it in my body. Tell me about intuition and feeling it in your body and how you balance that intuition with the data. And I'm going to add one more question to that. Can you teach intuition, or do some people just have more than others?
I believe that intuition's always there. And perhaps some are better at listening to it than others. And you can call intuition any number of things. But I feel like I when I am in a non-fear state, I'm very good at listening to intuition. Now, how do I balance that with data? I will listen to the data if the data is very obvious. So if I'm looking at LTV to CAC and it's sub one, there's really no intuition that's going to tell me that that's working. That's very clearly not working, right? But if something's a little bit more borderline and the data isn't able to provide a clear answer, that's where I will kind of lean on my intuition. And I'm usually pretty good at thinking about what the implications of something might be, or what are the unintended consequences that might arise, and really kind of playing more chess than checkers. So think a few moves down the board. Hey, if I do this, what's that behavior going to be? And so I try to combine those things when the data is ambiguous, because you're not always going to get a clear answer through data. Does that answer the question, Sherry?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think what I hear you saying is that what stood out to me is when you're not in fear. I was just listening to a podcast this morning. You and I got real personal at that breakfast lunch that we had at Bucks, and you were sharing your dyslexia with me and what that was like. And within 20 minutes, I shared that I had been diagnosed with ADHD. Late in life at 47. And I believe that a lot of people in our profession probably have it undiagnosed and don't know it. But in both instances, it's really a matter of, you know, dealing with fear and anxiety, which can be a part of that. And I think that, you know, what I hear you saying is it's not so much, you know, do I have intuition? Yes, it's always there. But can I get rid of the noise? Can I get rid of the mind chatter? Can I get rid of the self-doubt that pops up, which probably pops up for all people, but maybe especially when you've been diagnosed with some kind of disorder? So that really resonates. And so if you quiet that, what I heard you saying is that the intuition is there, and it's a matter of doing that. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that there is so much noise. I've had to learn this over time to the way that I tried to teach myself how to do this is, how do you distinguish fear from intuition? Because the feeling is like, and how do you distinguish the two? So what I try to make a practice of doing when I'm unsure is I remember a time when I made a decision when I knew I shouldn't have that. And I feel it in the body. I was going against my intuition. I was making a decision from fear. And I go back into that place of making that decision. And where did I feel it in the body? How did it show up for me? Then I go to a place where I made a decision that I knew was right, even though others were questioning me. Like taking the Zendesk job was an example of that. I had a lot of friends who were like, how are you going to do this job? You've never done a job that big working for a public company. But I knew in my soul that I was going to be good at that job, even though I was scared. But my intuition was like, no, you've got this. Mm-hmm. You can do this. And so I try to go back into those times of like, okay, this is what it felt like to make the right decision based on intuition. This is what the body felt like when I made a decision against it and I made it from fear. And then if I'm trying to make another decision, then I go back into the body, okay, what are we feeling? What's it more similar to? And that's taken me a lot of years and practice. I'm still not an expert at it, but stilling, grounding yourself, like, okay, I feel my feet on the ground. I feel the chair underneath me or whatever. I'm grounding myself in my body, re-putting myself in those circumstances and then trying to decipher the two. And I do find that to be helpful.
I love that you tied it to your, you know, job at Zendesk, because it's kind of very Zen. You know, it's got the, it's just really struck a chord with me as well, Jamie, with the, I wrote it down here, so I'm looking at it. It was, you know, when I'm not in a fear state, I listen to my intuition. And the thing that struck me is like, well, these days it seems like we're all in a fear state. Now, and I totally get your point, where it's like in your fear state or in a fear state, your intuition is flight, more than likely, maybe fight, but as often it's like just run away, right? It's hide. And so your intuition could tell you sort of weird things when you're in a state of fear. But, you know, I'm wondering, not about you per se, but you know, again, as a leader of, you know, some tens of hundreds of people and driving a culture, it just seems like where we are in the world today for many of us is in almost a pervasive state or a constant state of fear, anxiety, concern. I don't want to overstate it, but I think we all at the very least feel a little bit overwhelmed, whether it's what's going on at work, what's going on in the economy, what's going on in politics, what's going on in the environment. There is a lot, right? And so I'm wondering, does that mean, are we less able, or in fact, are we probably better off not tapping into our intuition in this world because our intuition is going to play games on us in this world and say, everybody, run away. Or is it, how do you, particularly as a leader, how do you help people tap into their intuition, dial down the fear, dial up the intuition? Is that something you think about or how do you do that?
It is, because it's actually, as a mother,
yeah,
my kids and with my colleagues and or the team that I'm working with. And this kind of ties into kind of a similar concept. But the other piece, which I'm sure you both will not find surprising, is over my course of my life, I like to control things in general, right? I like to think I control the outcomes of all things. Well, that's not true.
Right.
So, like, I will want to control out. I realized earlier in my motherhood, I'm like, oh, I've got to back off. And then also as a leader, I came in as way too controlling. And so I had to kind of adjust on both fronts. And I see a lot of my colleagues or teams working with me having a similar challenge. And so what I try to focus on myself and try to focus on with my colleagues too, that helps them get more into an intuitive state as opposed to a state of fear, is, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to focus on the controllable. So let's talk about the things that are on the plate right now, and let's categorize them. What's beyond our control? What is in our control? And we're going to have this filter. So things are going to come in. We're going to have to filter it. Does this go into the, you know what? I can't control this. I'm going to acknowledge it. And maybe there's something that another team or something else can be done about it, but I personally can't. So I'm going to put that over here. I'm going to focus on what I personally can control. So a simple example in sales might be that you don't have enough pipeline to hit your quota. Well, you could get really upset at marketing and say, hey, you're not doing enough of this, that, or the other thing. Or you could sit down and say, hey, listen, I'm going to be forthright. Hey, listen, I'm at 2 weeks. Not enough. I need to lean into that. What are some creative ways I can think of that I can help, you know, solve that issue? Certainly you could outbound. Certainly you could, are there partners? Like what are some relationships you might have in market that could help you fill that? So if you put yourself back in the driver's seat, instead of feeling like a victim of circumstance, you can be a lot more productive and kind of, I think, give yourself momentum. So it kind of takes you out of that state of fear and back into like, okay, yeah, this is not an ideal circumstance, but every single day I can make progress towards what I can control and in helping make this particular situation better.
It's such a simple framework, but I once heard it's simple, but if you're not doing it, it's advanced. And I think that really applies here. And so what I hear you saying is, and we are in a time right now of massive uncertainty, you know, tariffs, the economy, AI is going to take my jobs. I mean, I'm sure that you've got a team and you've got a large team of, like Brent said, of, you know, reps and managers that are in fear. And yet you've got this framework or this process of controllables versus non-controllables. I'm curious, is that something that is now adopted throughout your company and in your culture? Are people modeling that? Because it seems very helpful right now.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Because if you're focused on more of a how can I help mentality, that in general is going to dial down the drama in your organization. So what dials up the drama is the fear of uncertainty or of anything. And then you're going to get into a victim villain type of mentality. So if you want a low drama environment, you've got to be in a problem solving, how can I help? And I do think that on the commercial, you know, on the team, on the ELT, my peer level team, as well as the commercial team that I currently lead and teams I've led in the past, I'm listening for people slipping into victim villain language and taking a step back and working on perspective. So an example of this, and not at this company, but a prior company, we had an instance where marketing had done a really actually fabulous campaign and they had produced a lot of hand raisers for a cross-sell opportunity. They did, though, produce them all at once. And the CS team who was handling the post-sales team that was handling these couldn't quite handle. It was a good problem to have, great problem to have, but they couldn't handle the load. So what did they do? They blamed marketing for this terrible campaign that they ran and that they couldn't keep up with everything. I was like, okay, let's time out. Let's rephrase this. Marketing, great job. That was outstanding in terms of outcome. Next time, here's a challenge we ran into is that you did such a great job. We actually couldn't get to the customers fast enough. We couldn't hit the SLAs. That's not a great experience for the customer. That was the unintended impact of us setting them all at once. What are your thoughts if we were to throttle them with a little more space in between so we have an opportunity to hit those SLAs and get in front of those customers right away? I mean, marketing gets a high five because they've done a great job. Marketing says, absolutely. How about we space it like this? CS is happy. Marketing's happy. We did not need to complain that marketing's campaign was too successful.
I think the one thing we'd all agree, it's always marketing's fault, right? I mean, it's like the whole idea of throttling marketing is, I don't think that's how you meant it, but that's how I think some think about it. But let me ask you, it's actually kind of interesting. Is there, whether it's parenting or sales reps or professionals or just any context, as you think about this exercise in controllables, which makes a ton of sense, are there common patterns, to your point about pattern recognition, about either common false positives, things that I think I control, but I can't, or false negatives, things I actually can control, but don't think that I can? Are there patterns there that pop up that you find?
I think that, like, as a parent and as a worker, I think sometimes what we forget is that we don't have control over another person's choices.
Yeah.
And so a parenting example, my daughter could feel very hurt by a circumstance with one of her friends. And, you know, I think my first step is to acknowledge how she's feeling, not invalidate the fact that, yeah, that I can see where this interaction would feel really bad. And I can understand why you're feeling this way. And then get also to a point of, you know, unfortunately, one of the things we can't control is choices other people make. And people are sometimes going to make choices that hurt us. And then, you know, we have then are options on how we're going to respond to that. And what our choice is, do we understand that friend's just having a really bad day and we're going to give them some grace? Or is this a pattern and it's really hurtful? And do we need to think about if this friend is really the friend that we think it is? This happened recently, even with my daughter. And we laid out, I said, honey, I had to realize this is hurtful. I'll support whatever choice you make. Mm. And she decided to not do this thing with her friends. And she said, you know what? I'd rather go with you, mommy. I'm not going to do this one particular thing. But I made it clear that, like, I understood how she was feeling and that any option she decided of how she wanted to handle the situation, I would be supportive of her. And I think she felt some level of comfort and then control that she still had choice.
This is actually really good marital advice. Like, this is not a podcast on marital advice, but my God, I mean, you know, how much therapy, not me, of course, I've never been to therapy, you know, on you cannot change his behavior or anybody's behavior for that matter.
Or hers. I'm just saying.
Exactly. Like, we.
I'm just saying.
Well, this is the biggest relationship problem, right? We get into a marriage, we fall in love. Everything's incredible. It's so great. And then we all try to change each other, right? Just doesn't work. And what I love is that you're teaching this to your children. And everything you're saying, Jamie, I think why this is so powerful is these are universal truths. These frameworks that you're giving us, this isn't like framework for being a CRO. This is a framework for life. And you're right. We can't control somebody else's choices. We just can't. I'm curious, here you are now running a large organization. You're running deputy. By the way, how many employees do you have? How many direct reports do you have and how many employees?
I have a few too many direct reports. I have about 14 and probably about 200 or so under the org. And there's maybe 550 in the company as a whole. So it's a fair degree number of people. I realize the direct reports, I don't recommend it, but at the same time, I'm trying to balance what's economical and best for the company.
It's an uncontrollable, as you say, you've got 15 direct reports. So, you know, now I'm just sort of seeing this, you know, you've got 15 direct reports. That now is an uncontrollable. And I want to get back to how do you deal with that personally, that you've got this uncontrollable. You don't want to be in fear about that, but that's a lot of direct reports. And I've seen people at your level with as many as 30. I don't even know how that works. The military only allows you 5. Right? I mean, they kind of know something there. And how do you, just to bring this full circle, manage your fear and your stress level with 15 direct reports. I know you're a great mom. You've got, you know, 2 kids. You've got a wonderful CIO husband. How do you balance all that as a parent?
I think balancing it as a parent, let me answer that component first, is when my son was very young, I was working at Andreessen Horowitz at the time, which is a venture firm here in the Valley. And he was still a baby, so he needed to be watched in the bathtub. You couldn't just leave him in there. And I'd left work early, which probably meant 5:30, because I needed to leave the nanny and come home and bathe him and spend time with him before he went to bed. I mean, he used to go to bed at 7, so I didn't really have a lot of time with him. And I was trying to do too many things at once, and he's in the bathtub, he's playing, he's got his cars in there and, you know, splashing all over the place. He does one big splash and he goes whoosh right over my laptop. And my first reaction was to snap at him why he splashed my laptop. And the shock on his face at my response just like pierced me to my soul. And it was an epiphany of a moment of this is his time. And I've been gone all day and he's going to bed in an hour. And I'm going to yell at him because I'm choosing to do my laptop or answer email during the time that I'm supposed to be spending quality time with him. And I put that laptop to the side. I put it away. And to this day, I am unapologetically present when I'm with my kids or when I'm at work. I don't feel guilty when I'm at work. I really like working. I enjoy adding value. I enjoy being part of a team. I don't feel any guilt about that. But when I'm at a water polo game, my daughter who's a junior and she's varsity water polo, when I'm at that water polo game for that hour of that game, I'm not answering any Slacks. I'm not answering text messages. I'm not taking calls. I am watching that game for its entirety because I know those moments are fleeting and I want to be present and enjoy those moments. Those are core memories I want to make sure that I'm making. When I have dinner, if I'm home during the week, I'm putting the same thing. Slack, I'll take my watch off. I don't want it to buzz my wrist. I will sit down with the family and we'll have dinner because those are some of my most formative memories as a child was having dinner when my dad came home from work at night. So when I'm not traveling, I'm home. I try to be present for that as well. I think those moments are so important to build that relationship and build those memories with your family that you have plenty of other time to cover on work. So for me, that moment was just an epiphany of clarity, of releasing guilt in either sense when I'm with them or when I'm at work.
I'm still feeling the gaze of your son. You can feel it vicariously. That one hurts. It's like, ouch. Jill Conrath has got a new book coming out called Pivotal Moments. And this is exactly the kind of moment she's talking about, of these very small, unexpected moments that can literally change the course of your life. And this sounds like one that's pretty made a huge impression. Kind of picking up that, Jamie, at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that you recently introduced yourself to the deputy team. And I'm wondering, how'd you do that? What did you want them to know about you?
Oh, so the company will, every month they do a spotlight on a different employee.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely tradition and they will get backgrounds. They will get baby pictures and you just learn a bit about your colleagues. And let me tell you, this curly hair was awesome in the 80s and the 90s. So I had some stellar, full 80s long curly hair with no perm. Like I look really well. So I wanted to share here. I thought that it was important. I did actually share some of these moments that I've shared with you of having to have grit and resilience and having people tell you no and still leaning in even if they did and holding on to your confidence even when other people are trying to knock you out of your state of confidence. And I wanted them to see how important that my priorities of my life are because I think it's important that the team recognize that when things are so uncertain and when they're so stressful, it's really easy to get so roped up into work that you're not actually enjoying the things that are going to matter to you. Like when you die, you're not going to wish, gosh, darn it, I wish I'd worked all the weekends and I wish I'd worked 20-hour days. You're going to say, gosh, darn it, I shouldn't have missed that water polo game. And so one of the points I made sure to hit home was this story about my son, which is not a proud moment as a mom. It does hit home because you can see his face and that is not a proud moment for me. But I share it because I think, you know, philosophically, I care about my family first, my health second, and my work third. And I will make decisions based on that priority. And I wanted my colleagues and the company to feel comfortable prioritizing those things too, because that's what's ultimately going to matter over time, you know?
Totally. Yeah. It's such an interesting sort of, you know, the word, it's weird that when I read your bio and watched a couple of podcasts you've done and looked at your background, this is going to sound very strange to you, I imagine, but the first word that came to my mind was the word polyglot. I don't know if you know a polyglot is someone who speaks many languages, right? And it seems to me that, you know, with your background in engineering and math, but yet you're really good at English and literature and the fact that you are, you know, a world-class trained engineer, but you work with salespeople who are often, some are actually very incredible engineers, but many of them aren't. In fact, many went into sales specifically because they didn't want to do that kind of work, right? And so, but you seem to have this really keen, canny ability to speak multiple languages, as it were, to touch people in, you know, who come at life from very different kinds of perspectives, whether it's left brain or right brain or whatever it might be. And I don't know if that's how you think about it, but I'd love to get a sense from you of like how you seem to be so able to make such a tight, great, powerful connection to so many different kinds of people. Is that something you think about?
I have not ever thought about that. You could be very well be right. I think what I try to do is just like instinctually recognize where people are coming from and trying to understand, not questioning intention. I've gotten good at like interacting with someone and maybe some interaction happens that you could think maybe it could be perceived as a negative interaction. And I usually will try to pause and think, okay, what would a reasonable, rational person think about this? Like, what's the intent, right? Let's not make a story about this. What's a rational intent that this person was trying to accomplish? And they might be coming at it from a different perspective than I am, but their intentions are, in general, people's intentions are in a good place. They're probably just coming about it a different way. Or you can also watch reactions sometimes with people and I'm like, oh, they felt embarrassed and that embarrassment and shame got turned into anger. Mm-hmm. And so my daughter is actually very good at this. So I don't know if we just kind of like have this intuition, but I remember her coming home and telling me one of the classmates was very mean to her. And I said, well, Kaylin, how did you feel about that? And she said, well, mommy, so-and-so was having a really rough day. And I think she was picking it out on me.
Wow.
And that was a very evolved way to look at that situation and not take it personally. And so I think I don't say I'm perfect, but I try to do my best to try to understand where that other person is coming from, because it's not about me. It's about them. And how can I kind of best meet them where they are? So I can kind of speak the engineering language. I'm married to one. Not all the time. Sometimes I get lost in those discussions. I'll admit. Wait, what? Can you try that layman's terms? And then I kind of have that my mom's an artist. You know, I've got like that intuitive, more creative side to me too. So I think I just kind of try to understand where someone's coming from.
But, you know, especially today, I think it's so important where, I mean, not to go there, and so I won't go there completely, but let's face it, we live particularly in the United States, in a country where we are becoming more polarized than ever before across a number of different dimensions. And it just seems to me that if we are going to succeed and even maybe not to be too dramatic, survive as a country and as a polity, we've got to find ways to kind of build the kinds of bridges that you're talking about and sort of start with a place of thinking about intention and building connection. And, you know, this applies as parents, as professionals, and just as citizens. So I find in what you're saying hope, but I also find it is just like hard work and also a little exhausting, but critically important. It's just how finding that connection is so hard sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it, especially now. I think social media has its pluses and minuses, but what I can see in the younger generations is it is polarizing them.
Yeah.
I will have my kids come home and feel bad because they have a different point of view than one of their friends on one of the topics.
Yeah.
And their friends will be like, especially in the Bay Area, their friends will say, well, you're evil then. Like, if you don't agree with us, then you're a bad person. And they'll come home crushed. And what we try to instill in them, like what my husband and I believe, is that if you look at the world at a lens, like you're right and everybody else is wrong, we're just going to continue to get pulled and pulled farther apart. And we try to teach them, think independently. Like, look at things objectively and think independently. And just because someone has a different point of view, that's great. You know what? You might learn something from that. So we want to immerse ourselves in that. I'll tell you my uncle, who passed away a couple of years ago, but one of the things he said to me that I still haven't done, he said, Jamie, you've got to see this country from the ground. You can't just fly over it. You've got to go road trip through the United States and meet people in the towns and understand others. And there's no other way to do that than if you do it from the ground. And I think it was very sage advice, because what he was basically saying is, if you peel everything back, the same things matter to everyone.
Agreed.
They want security for their family. Mm. They want a job. They want education. So regardless of what side of this polarization you're coming from, tell me that's not what everybody ultimately wants. We might think of different paths of how to get there, but ultimately we all have the same goal. And it was a really good reminder of what the North Star is, instead of demonizing one side or the other.
You know, I love that you said that. You reminded me, and I hadn't thought about this in a long time. I remember in high school, I came home once. I'm Jewish, Holocaust. My mother's a Holocaust survivor. And my best friend, one of my best friends was Mormon. The other one was Christian. The other one was Catholic. And I remember going home and saying to my mother, "Mom, I don't understand. How can Colleen and Kathy and Kelly all be wrong and we be right?" And I was so upset. And you talk about sage advice from parents, right? And my mother said, "Oh no, Sherry, we're all right. You see, God has many different children and he treats them all differently. To some he sent Moses, to some he sent Jesus. We all want the same thing."
Right.
And it just stuck with me. And Brent, what you said about how polarized we are, and then Jamie, what you said about intent. And that's really the word that stands out to me today. You know, what is the intent and what's the story that we're making up about why they said that? Because that's what gets us into trouble in communication. Oh, they did that because they don't like me. No, they were scared. They were ashamed. And if you go to the emotion, which is what I hear you saying behind the words, it develops, then you see things and you see people very, very differently.
100%. That's exactly right. It's intent. And then it's recognizing where they might be coming from, and it's not about you. We have a tendency to make the stories about ourselves when we have a negative interaction. It's mostly not about us. It's really about the other person. And sometimes you have to remind yourself, like, again, go back to feeling that in the body. Okay, that didn't feel great, but let me rationally kind of think about, let's not make up a story about this, but rationally think about why that interaction might have happened from the other side. And I think if we just pause and like realign with intent, we'd be shocked at how aligned we really all are.
You know, it's interesting to me because, you know, Sherry, as you're fond of saying, you know, the name of the podcast is Selling Isn't Everything, but as you like to say, but it sure is something, right? And to me, I think everything that you're saying, Jim, it just resonates so strongly because in many ways, it's the heart and soul of the book that I just put out, Framing Sale, which is how do we engage customers in such a way that we change the way they think, not about us, but think about themselves. It's the same sort of thing that we apply. So we can apply it in parenting. We can apply it in leadership. We can apply it in our own organizations and our families. And we can also apply it all the way full circle, Sherry, back to Selling Is Something in the sales interaction. So we can engage customers in such a way that we're focused on helping them feel better about themselves. And to me, that it is so aspirational across any one of these dimensions, but it seems like it just keeps coming back as the right answer for all of it.
Yeah, I mean, in sales, 100%. So initially when I was trained on negotiation, as an example, it was the what's. What do you want? What do they want? That's actually not the question. The real question is, why do they want it? What is the underlying interest or what is the intent behind the what? And if you can understand that, then you know how to structure the deal because now you understand what their challenge is or what they're trying to accomplish. But just understanding the what doesn't actually get you there. So it kind of, you're right, it threads through life of like, what is the intent? What's the interest? What's the why? And I think in sales, it's just as we've done really large partnership deals here at Deputy. And how were they successful? It's because we understood the underlying interests and what the other party really needed to accomplish.
Jamie, everything you say is so incredibly wise. You know, it's funny, we usually end this podcast with, selling isn't everything, but it's something. What is it for you? But I feel like that's what this whole podcast has been, which is so, so beautiful. And I'm sure that our listeners and watchers want to know, how the heck do we get a hold of Jamie Buss? So can you just share, how can we get a hold of you? Actually, before you do that, I'd like to know, is there something that you're working on that you'd like to share with other people? And then how can they get a hold of you?
So I wish there was something I was working on that I'd love to share with other people, but I have to admit right now, my life is my family and my work. But someday, I'll definitely share that with you all. And I think the best way is to reach me either certainly on LinkedIn. So connecting on LinkedIn. And then if folks want to connect to me directly on email, I can share that as well. If that's helpful.
Sure. We can put that in the show notes. I think
absolutely. Yeah. And Jimmy, I had one last question. It's tongue in cheek, but I'm kind of actually seriously curious, which is how many people think you own the Los Angeles Lakers? Does that come up ever or does that never come up?
It does. Especially my mother gets asked if she's married to Jerry Buss all the time. And then right. I get asked if I'm Jerry Buss's daughter because I think she's around the same age. And I think her name is Jamie Buss.
It's Jeannie. Yeah, it's Jeannie versus Jamie. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't hear the sound, but I was close. But I do get asked, oh, are you related to Jerry Buss? I'm like, nope, I'm related to Dave Buss and you don't know who he is.
So there you go. You're amazing in your own. You don't own the Los Angeles Lakers, but you own our hearts because that was amazing. Yeah.
So talking to Jamie, I feel like a better human just after listening to her. I don't know how you feel, but I'm curious for you, Brent, what are the two or three moments that really stood out to you or lessons that stood out to you?
Well, there's a couple, and I don't want to ask you a question too, Sherry, but I think the story that really stands out is probably for any of us who have children is that moment when, you know, you're sitting by the bathtub of your son and he accidentally gets water in your laptop and you get mad and he looks at you. Because that look that she described is a look we've all seen in our children's eyes at one point or another. And the feeling in this pit of your stomach that you get when you get that look and you question everything about your own ability as a parent and why you're here and your priorities. I felt that one. I just felt it. And it was interesting that little moment became such a pivotal moment for her and how she thought about, you know, it still has implications or ramifications today for how she thinks about not only like things like time management, but how she leads and how she engages with other people. I found it incredibly powerful.
And probably why she attracts so many good people because they feel seen. And I want to ask you, you just said that really stuck with you. Was there a pivotal moment for you when that happened with children and work-life balance? And I'm going daily. Deep here, Brad. I want to know.
Oh, Sherry. I mean, you've heard me say this before, and I mean it every time I say it, although it sounds like a line, right? Which is I'm 20 years into being a parent. I still don't know what I'm doing. I mean, and I think that's the dirty little secret that none of us like to say out loud is whether it's being a parent or a professional or a leader or a CRO, it's like none of us really honestly know what we're doing. And I think if we show up and claim that we know what we're doing, that's actually a dangerous place to be, right? So it's not to say that we're incompetent or that, but it's okay to sort of embrace this uncertainty and get up every morning and look it in the eye and say, I don't know what I'm doing, and yet I'm going to go do it anyway. And that's what Jamie, that's her story. And I think it's all of our stories. And I think that's why it resonates so strongly is because these are the kinds she said out loud, the kinds of things that most of us feel like not only we shouldn't say out loud, but we can't say out loud. And that's how we make these tighter human connections is when we begin to realize all these things that we're not saying, but feeling are the same things that everyone else is not saying, but feeling. Do you know what I mean?
No, I totally know what you mean. And particularly now in a time of AI, right? I mean, content's cheap. But you said something, you know, about Jamie that I found really interesting is that very often I see people get paralyzed by fear, paralyzed by perfectionism. They want all the answers. They want all the information, right? Before they will just do it anyway. Yet she admittedly went to Zendesk and everybody said, how do you know you can do it? You're not qualified for this. How are you going to do this? And she just figured it out as she went, as we do in parenting or anything else. If we're successful, this is what successful people do. Not all people do this.
Yeah. Did you notice, this is someone, again, trained as an engineer and a very successful engineer at one of the world's premier engineering organizations or universities. And did you notice how many times she would say something like, I felt it in my body? It's like, wait, did we just step into yoga class or are we talking to an engineer? And the fact that she can co-present both of those traits simultaneously to me is just, I think, probably one of the many things that just makes her so successful because it's this whole, you know, we say trust your gut. But she's quite literally saying trust your gut because you can feel it literally in your body when a decision feels right or wrong. And that also just really struck a chord with me because I do that all the time. I don't really think about it the way she clearly does.
Yeah. And I loved your joke about Zendesk, right? Like the word Zen, right? But no, she did. She did do that a lot. She said, I feel it in my body. Which is it's really interesting.
Engineers don't talk like that. You know what I mean? Engineers don't say I feel it in my body.
The good ones do. Or maybe they feel it in their body, but they don't articulate that they feel it in their body. And what I wanted to ask her is, have you done self-development work? I mean, this is very sort of enlightened, if you will. This is very Jamie's very self-aware. And she teaches that to her children. And she's looking at, okay, you're angry. What is anger? Well, I always heard anger is just fear turned inward. You know, that anger is what you see on the outside, but people are really afraid. And once we understand the emotional state of another human, that's when she could stop and pause and not tell herself a story, look at things differently, and find the commonality. And that's what really stuck with me, is how she did that. So yeah, there was that sort of yogic moment in all of her communication.
You know, she mentioned pattern recognition. The pattern I'm beginning to recognize, Sherry, and I'll only speak for myself on this one, is, you know, you think Maria Bolden, Don Yeager, your brother, Jelaine, Jamie. I'm beginning to realize that every single one of these episodes is just me walking away thinking, I'm just not as good as that person. That's my pattern recognition.
When you're on a podcast, you sound really good on a podcast, because do we just put on our best selves when we're on a podcast?
Maybe so. Maybe that's it. But here's the question I want to ask you, and maybe this is a good way to sum it up. So I'd never met her before, and now I just feel like what a pleasure having met her. And I get to thank you for that. So thank you for introducing us together on the show. You had met her. I don't know the full context, detail, summary, like how you guys met. I don't know if you wanted to, if there's anything in that story. But my question is, clearly when you met her, and you mentioned this early on in the conversation, it was an almost immediate recognition of, wow, this is someone I like to know and someone I'd like to be friends with. What is it that you saw in her almost immediately that led you to that sort of almost, you know, reactive, that sort of instant recognition of like, this person's special. What was it?
In a word, vulnerability. And we met, we both serve on the board of Grow AI. It's a, as you know, a new AI company, solving coaching problem. And she had come, we had a big party for the founders of Grow AI with some VCs and early investors. And she was there and I never got a chance to meet her. And I felt bad. I thought, gosh, you know, I had somebody in my home, you know, she looked cool. And I, you know, we were all flitting around. And so I reached out to one of the founders, Alex, and I said, can you connect me with Jamie? And I wanted to meet her from a business perspective. I thought, we're going to be serving on this board together, you know, and this, you know, business connections are good. Certainly in my line of work, she's the CRO. And, you know, I sort of had my business hat on, and we met at Bucks. We sat down, and in an hour and a half, we never discussed what we did at all. We right away started talking about children. She told me about her being dyslexic. That gave me permission to tell her that, you know, about being diagnosed with ADHD and what that was like. And then she said, oh my gosh, my daughter's ADHD. And we started sharing what it was like being a parent. And I shared with her what it was like when I became a parent, and sort of like a bathtub moment that I had, where I realized once I became a parent that the five rules of empathy that I teach just don't work. You know, like, well, I'm going to apply the five rules of empathy to raise my son. Well, they'll call you out real quick. I think it was that, Brent. It was this connection as parents and as humans. And I don't think we've talked a lot about her business. And like I said, I've got this whole long list of her accomplishments. But this is what this podcast is all about. It's what's underneath all of that that drew me to her. Yeah.
Well, and you know, to kind of sum it up, is what she said at the end, which is, I think, what you and I both deeply believe as well, which is, when you just not scratch the surface, but get just past these superficial differences, which seem to be really tearing us apart in so many different ways today, you find the same set of values or very similar sets of values in terms of things like safety, security, respect. And if we can find ways to connect at that level, we'll find that in many ways we're more likely able to overcome what oftentimes turn out to be superficial differences. And I think that where we landed with that conversation is, in many ways, I think where we all probably need to start every day when we get up, you know, face the day and think, I don't know if I'm ready to do this. It's like, go out into the world and do that. That feels worthy.
Yeah.